TalkZone.com.
Now, the Wild About Pets radio show, the place to learn something new about household pets and wild animals. Here's your host, educator and naturalist, Susan Frank.
Are you a meat eater? In this country, America, it's pretty widespread practice and considered fairly normal, eating meat. And there's a general consensus of what animals are considered appropriate to eat and which ones are not. We tend not to eat our pets. But why do we love and protect only certain animals and eat and wear other ones? Today, the topic of the show and the title of my guest's book, Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. Now, you might think that the answer would be pretty simple and obvious, but as I read the book and really started thinking about my own conflicted feelings and habits, I found there's a lot more to this. Now, today during the show, I'll be asking Dr. Melanie Joy some of my own questions and sharing some of my own stories, and I'll hope that you'll call in and share yours as well. Welcome, Dr. Melanie Joy. I am so thrilled to have you on the show today.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. It's really my pleasure.
Dr. Melanie Joy is a social psychologist and professor of psychology and sociology at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Now, we're going to be looking at some photos that will illustrate the conversation today. So if you'd like to see them while you're listening, make sure you have the TalkZone.com player window open. It shows me live in the studio, and the photos will flash in the window as we talk. Dr. Joy, what is the imagined situation that you like to pose to people to start them thinking about which animals they will eat and which they will not, that you use both in your book and on a little video clip that we also have?
It's a great question and a great way to start. So I ask people to imagine that they are a guest at a fancy dinner party. Imagine that you're sitting down to a delicious beef stew. And in fact, the stew is so delicious that you ask the host for her recipe. And flattered, she replies, well, sure, the secret's in the meat. You need to start with 3 pounds of USDA grade A golden retriever. When people hear that, their response is often one of shock, and what typically happens is that what they had seen just moments before on their plate as food, they now see as a dead animal. What they had found just moments before as delicious, they now find disgusting. So what's really interesting is that the experience, you know, one's experience of eating the meat dramatically changes, even though nothing about the meat itself actually changed. The flavor's the same, the texture's the same, the aroma's the same. What changed is simply the diner's perception of the meat.
Our phone lines are open. It's April 8th. If you want to call in and talk about this interesting topic with us, the number to call is 888-463-6748, or you can email me at susan@wildaboutpets.net to ask Dr. Joy a question about how we choose which animals to eat. Well, so, Dr. Joy, why is it that certain meats do cause such a strong emotional reaction, like the disgust and revulsion? I wonder about that myself, because as we are talking, I'll tell you some of my experiences, and we'll find out a little bit about yours. But what is it that is the difference, really, between, you know, what we are disgusted and revolted by and what we find so delectable?
Well, that's a great question. In meat-eating cultures around the world, people tend to have a tiny handful out of animals, out of thousands of possible species, that they have learned to classify as edible. All the rest we learn to classify as inedible and therefore disgusting. And so even though the type of species consumed changes from culture to culture, our experience remains fairly consistent. All cultures tend to find their own choices as rational, and the choices of other cultures as often irrational and offensive and disgusting. So what's really striking is not the presence of disgust. Disgust is the norm. It's the rule rather than the exception.
Mm-hmm.
What's striking is the absence of disgust. The question for us really is, why are we not disgusted by the, you know, 3, 4, 5, or 6 animal species that we've learned to classify as edible? And this was the question that I started asking when I was conducting my doctoral dissertation on the psychology of eating meat. And what I found was that there's a gap in our consciousness. There is a disconnect when it comes to eating edible animals. we don't make the conscious connection between the meat on our plate and the animal it once was, the living being it once was. It's like we're on autopilot.
Mm-hmm. And we really are willingly participating in this distancing ourselves or going along with not wanting to think about it, aren't we?
Well, it's a very interesting point. Yes and no. One of the things that, I mean, we are participating. We are going along with this. I grew up eating animals for most of my life.
So did I.
So you can relate to what I'm saying. And I also grew up with a dog who I loved like a family member. And I never thought about the inconsistencies in my attitudes and behaviors toward animals, how I could be petting my dog with one hand and eating, for instance, my pork chop with the other. You know, pork chop that had come from a living being who had been at least as sensitive, intelligent, and conscious as my dog. And I didn't make that connection because I actually never even thought I had a choice when it came to eating animals. So you ask about, you know, your question is, are we willing participants? I mean, nobody's holding a gun to our heads when we eat animals, but they don't actually have to because we're so socialized into this mindset. We're eating animals before we can even say our own name.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I really stress in my book is that we, without awareness, there really is no free choice. If we're not aware of this gap in our consciousness, if we're not aware of the system that I call carnism that I'll talk about in just a couple of minutes, then we really are not aware that we have a choice or that we're making a choice every time we eat meat.
Yes. So explain, what do you mean by carnism? What is this?
Well, when I was conducting my research, I had started out with an interest in the individual psyche. And what I found quite quickly was that there was much more to the picture than just individual attitudes and behaviors toward animals, that there was a common theme. Every single participant I interviewed had a very similar experience, either eating or working with meat. They were butchers, for instance, or people who had raised and killed their own animals for food. And I discovered that there is, in fact, this invisible belief system that I call carnism that conditions us to disconnect psychologically and emotionally from the truth of our experience when it comes to eating animals that we have learned to classify as edible. So we, most of us, are completely unaware of this system, and so we're not aware of the ways in which it has conditioned us to act against our core values and our own interests and the interests of others. You know, coming back to my own story, I always considered myself an animal lover.
Mm-hmm.
I loved my dog. You know, I was one of those kids that would be rescuing animals all the time. And yet I was eating their bodies multiple times a day. And I didn't make that connection. And this is because of this system that is carnism. It's an invisible system. We tend to recognize vegetarianism or veganism as belief systems, but we don't recognize that eating meat is in fact a reflection of a belief system, because when eating meat is not a necessity for survival, it's a choice, and choices always stem from beliefs.
Yes, later on we're going to talk about the idea of, is this really normal and natural, and is it a necessity? So we'll get into that. But there's something I liked very much in your first chapter, Dr. Joy, where looking at what's going on and why, you know, can we think one food is palatable and edible and another one not? You say the answer to these questions can be summed up by a single word, perception. We react differently to different types of meat, not because there's a physical difference between them, but because our perception of them is different. And I really, that kind of helped me understand even my own story with, I really like pigs as an animal. And I know they've gotten kind of this bad reputation. You know, people have this idea of what they're like. And, you know, you can talk about, you do this wonderful exercise in your class that will illustrate this a little bit. But I know they're intelligent animals, and I really like them. And yet I also really enjoy barbecued ribs. And through my life, Dr. Joy, I have been very conflicted, because if I really want to eat the ribs, I have to stop thinking. I literally have to basically put blinders on what I really feel about these animals. And I go back and forth. And so, and I know my perception changes. You know, if I ignore it, then I can eat it. If I don't ignore it, I can't eat them.
And that's a perfect example of what I write about in my book. And, you know, and I really commend your willingness and ability to reflect on mm-hmm. your innermost experience, because I know that it's challenging to do that. And you're absolutely right. It really does come down to perception. And what Carnism does is it operates in a similar way to other isms, other exploitive systems, that require, you know, whose tenets, whose teachings run counter to core human values. You know, values such as compassion and empathy and justice. And so what Carnism does is it uses a set of defense mechanisms on a social and psychological level so that humane people are able to participate in inhumane practices without realizing what we're doing. These defense mechanisms really distort our perceptions of meat and the animals we eat so that we can feel comfortable enough to consume mm-hmm. them. They teach us to disconnect psychologically and emotionally from the truth of our experience, to have that gap in our consciousness, you know, that you describe, where, you know, you really have to block your thoughts and block your empathy mm-hmm. in order to eat the body of another sentient being.
We were talking earlier about your example of the golden retriever and, if you know, how people would react if they found that that was in their stew. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some people in America who are not disgusted by the idea of eating dogs. Why would that be?
Well, Carnism really doesn't describe necessarily the content or the what. It describes the process or the how. So Carnism is a system that teaches us to think and feel and act in certain ways that distance us from the reality of those animals or the meat of those animals that we have learned to classify as edible. So around the world, people may have different types. They do have different types of animals that they're more comfortable consuming. But their experience is fairly consistent. In some places in the world, people would never eat cows, but they have no problem eating chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have no, you know, would not eat chickens, but they have no problem eating pigs. So it is the same process throughout many meat-eating cultures in the world. What changes is simply the type of species that that culture has classified as edible.
Mm-hmm. And we all basically buy into it. Isn't there kind of a widespread cultural acceptance?
Well, yes, there is a widespread cultural acceptance, and I think it's very important to one of my goals of raising awareness about Carnism is that, you know, I believe, as I said earlier, that without awareness there is no free choice. And so one of my goals is to help people to kind of step out of the system so that they can see the system with their own eyes rather than look at the world through the lens of Carnism. And acceptance is something, I think it can imply that there's some level of awareness, and many people have, you know, this, I describe it in my book, it's been referred to by others as this knowing without knowing. You know, on one level, when we meet, we're aware that, of course, somebody had to die for our place,
mm-hmm.
you know, but on another level, we often just don't connect the dots.
Mm-hmm.
There's that gap in our consciousness again. And the reason that this kind of behavior, which is, you know, the brutal raising and killing, or I should say breeding and slaughter of, you know, billions and billions of non-human animals. The reason that there is such widespread acceptance is because there is such a lack of awareness and such a strong socialization for us to not ask these questions. I mean, it's really striking that we learn in our culture to spend more time thinking about what brand of shampoo to buy than about which species of animals we eat and why, when our choices as food consumers have a profound impact on our own bodies and minds. And, you know, they're really a matter of life and death for billions of other beings.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Melanie Joy, author of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. Our phone lines are open. We're streaming live. It's April 8th. Call 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-GO-FOR-IT. Or email me at susan@wildaboutpets.net to ask Dr. Joy a question about the animals we choose to eat and the animals we choose not to. I'm looking at a picture number 9, Dr. Joy, after we saw one of the photographs of a pig. We're looking at another pig that a number of years ago became very popular as a pet, the pot-bellied pig. And I find this very interesting that here's an animal that so many Americans love to eat. Mm-hmm. So here we have, in my mind, this dichotomy. Here's this, you know, farm equals food, pig is food, and then this pet. And so how do you see society helping play a part in identifying animals as either prey or predator, pest, pet or food?
Well, when we're born into the system, you know, we learn, we're taught to classify animals in certain ways. We're taught, you know, there are lots of different categories in which we classify animals. And the one that I've been most interested in is the edible versus inedible dichotomy, or the edible-inedible classification. And, you know, within this, there's are other ones, you know, other dichotomies as well. So, for instance, I interviewed a butcher who told me that he had met a man once who had a pig as a pet. And he said, well, I can eat pork, I can eat bacon. I mean, it's my job, I love it. But if this man killed his own pig and served him to me, I would never eat the pig because I know him.
Mm-hmm.
And so carnism, you know, one of the ways that carnism encourages us to really, you know, not ask these questions, to psychically numb ourselves, is by distorting our perceptions so that we tend to see animals, for instance, as objects. So the animals who become our food, we don't think of them as someone, we think of them as something. We don't think of them as individuals. Carnism teaches us to de-individualize the animals that become our foods, to see them as abstractions. So again, you know, a pig is a pig and all pigs are the same. We don't think of them as having an individual identity unless we've experienced a pig that we perceive as an individual. And that may, in fact, influence us to stop eating pigs, or we may say, well, this pig is an individual, so therefore I could never eat him or her. But in general, we tend to see them as abstractions in our minds. And it's much easier to carry out violence toward someone when you think of them as an object, mm-hmm. or when you don't think of them as an individual with preferences, with a character, with feelings, with a life that matters to them.
Mm-hmm. I used to work at a conservation area in Illinois, and in addition to a gorgeous old-growth forest, they have a farm there, and people could come, and the families would be able to pet, you know, the little lambs and the little pigs and see the chickens. And the program we taught there was called Farm Equals Food, and right there was some of the initial teaching that you're referring to, that yes, these animals are wonderful to look at, but make no mistake, children, this is a food here. And that's, I see that's when we started teaching that. And I also felt, well, wait, there's some importance in doing that so that they make this connection. But I know it was participating in this objectification.
Right, and that's a very interesting example. In my book, I talk about how when I was younger, there was a petting zoo outside of the grocery store that my parents used to shop at.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and at the time, I didn't realize, again, how strange it was that people would be crowded around the fence, reaching out, you know, desiring this, you know, natural, we feel this natural connection for animals. Many of us feel this natural connection. We want to touch them. We want to make contact. And people would be leaning over the fence, children and their parents alike, you know, stretching out their hands, vying for, you know, the chance to pet the cow's cheek or throwing food to the chicks, and really just not see the absurdity of walking into the grocery store 5 minutes later and buying packaged body parts of mm-hmm. these same species. And, you know, this is really where we can see how carnism is so effective in socializing us to block our awareness and shut down our empathy. We don't see the absurdities of the system when we're looking at the world through the lens of the system, essentially. We don't recognize this as at all bizarre, but it really is a very bizarre experience.
When we come back, Dr. Joy's story and why she wrote the book. Stay with us.